Here's okay. yesterday's.
Yesterday's sign up first, okay? Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. It is Thursday, June the 19th, 2003. At this time, I'm going to open up a public hearing without a quorum present for the purpose of taking testimony on House Bill 3002. I will hear a little bit about that. Okay.
Mr. Chair and member of the subcommittee, House Bill 3002 makes county service districts and cities that provide public transportation services eligible to receive money from state agency mass transit assessment. Currently, we have 10 mass transit or transportation districts that receive up to a maximum of a 0.6% mass transit assessment on payroll. And it's distributed to those folks. This bill, if passed, would allow 16 cities to become eligible for that assessment effective January 1, 2004. This bill does have some language in it regarding county service districts. That particular provision was handled in another bill, House Bill 2035, that was signed by the governor in early April. So county service districts have been taken care of, so there's not an additional fiscal from this bill. Based on some information from the Department of Administrative Services about the employees that we had employed earlier this spring and allocated within these 16 cities that would become eligible, there's a fiscal impact before you. We've estimated at the maximum 0.6%, that would be roughly $4 million fiscal impact of the state total funds, 1.8 of that being general fund.
Does that include the university costs also?
It includes university employees, yes.
Okay. Very good. Well, we have folks signed up from yesterday, and I promised they could go first. I'm not seeing a couple of them here, but Stuart Warshaw from the city of Corvallis, and I believe this is Mark McCambridge. Come on up. And, both of you, come on up. We have three seats here. If you would, give us your name for the record, and then proceed at your convenience.
Chair Roach and George and committee members, my name is Stuart Warshaw. I'm a member of the City Council of Corvallis, and I thank you for allowing me to testify here today. It's the first time I've ever done this in the state legislature. So
we're just citizens that got picked for this job. So don't worry about it. You're going to be fine.
Thank you. Corvallis citizens have a long history of supporting transit through financial support, citizen usage of the transit system, implementation of policies and programs to encourage the use of alternative transportation needs. Demand for transit service in Corvallis has quadrupled over the last 20 years, reaching over 500,000 rides last year. Oregon State University ridership makes up over 43% of the rides on the Corvallis transit system and over 60% on the Philomath Connection. The Oregon State University campus receives a significant amount of the transit service provided by the city of Corvallis. However, the lack of frequency and later operating hours deters many staff and students from using transit service. OSU students who are unable to live on campus are unable to reach the OSU library and other campus resources in the evening because of the limited transit hours. This has long been an issue with students who are finding affordable housing farther away from campus. The demand for services on Corvallis and Philomath transit systems outweighs the ability for the two cities to provide the service needed because of competing budget priorities. Transit districts around the state are better able to meet this demand because of the payments made by those state agencies who receive transit service and compensate the districts for this service. It has already been noted that transit districts and cities provide transit services which are not treated equitably for the transit services they provide to the state agencies. There is another equity issue which I would like to address. The city's transit system is primarily funded, approximately 78%, by local taxpayers. Privately owned businesses such as Hewlett-Packard, CHM Two Hill, and Corvallis Clinic pay property taxes to the city for transit service. To make the situation even more inequitable, the services, private businesses receive a lower level of service than state agencies in Corvallis. If HB 3002 is approved, the state would pay the share of local transit service provided by cities and still have an advantage over private businesses paying local taxes. State agencies would be exempt from our parking requirements. This provision would be particularly beneficial to the state and Oregon State University. Oregon State University currently is required by Corvallis Land Development Code to comply with specific requirements when any proposed development results in traffic and or parking impacts. One example of savings which could have occurred if Oregon State University was not subject to the city's parking requirements is the construction of the OSU Alumni Center. OSU was required to construct 161 parking spaces as part of the center's construction. The cost to construct service parking space is approximately $5,000 to $7,000 per space. This cost increases to between $15,000 and $25,000 for a parking structure. The parking construction alone cost of 161 parking spaces in the service lot alone amounts to between $800,000 to $1 million. If a parking structure had been built, those costs would have been increased to $2 to $4 million. Those parking spaces must be maintained, and the land cannot be used for any other purpose, such as another parking project. The City of Corvallis would like to be partnered with the State of Oregon, as it is with its individual and business taxpaying partners, in addressing the transportation needs of its state agencies and citizens through compensation for the transit service that it receives. Thank you on behalf of the City of Corvallis for your time today and your serious consideration of HB 3002. And I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Wershaw? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for coming. Could you elaborate a little bit more on the rationale for savings with respect to the Alumni Center? The assumption would be that at least some percentage, I assume not all, of persons using that parking requirement would in turn use the transit facilities. And that
Senator George, Senator Morris, the issue is that under the bill, in return for paying the assessment in here, they would not have to build the amount of parking that we require under our code. For instance, and in that situation, those 161 spaces would not have been required. And so the cost of building them would not have been there. This is of importance because they are also looking at a physical development plan. It's not that they will be coming to the City Council, and there will be with more buildings that they're talking about putting in. And at that point, the parking issue comes up again. We have that problem continually on the City Council. That's one of the things we look at when we see a development arise, is the parking issue. This is one way of helping out the university. And I know one counselor has had problems with her ward as far as parking is concerned. She's right around the university. And I think this would be a benefit to the university that way.
Thank you very much.
Good morning.
Good morning,
Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Lloyd. I'm the Associate Vice President of Finance and Administration and Director of Facilities at Oregon State University, filling in for Mark McCambridge today.
All right.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Thank you for this opportunity to testify regarding House Bill 3002. We agree entirely that the City of Corvallis deserves some compensation for the transportation services it provides to Oregon State University. We disagree, however, on the method by which these payments should be assessed. I am sorry that we must bring a local disagreement to the legislature for resolution, especially when we believe a local solution could address the city's concerns. Corvallis does currently receive significant state compensation for the services it provides. Last year, OSU provided the following support for the City of Corvallis to operate its bus system. Through student fee assessments, the city received $87,000 from OSU students. The students recently approved an increase in fees that will increase this amount next year. OSU directly paid the City of Corvallis an additional $20,000 for bus service to encourage ridership. These funds come directly from OSU's State General Fund appropriations. OSU also paid the City of Albany $12,000 for the operation of the Len Benton Loop to encourage ridership for those students that are enrolled in our dual admission program between OSU and Len Benton County Community College. These figures do not account for the significant additional investments OSU has made in operating a campus shuttle that moves students around the campus and adjacent neighborhoods, in sheltered bicycle parking and bikeways, and in vanpools that enable employees to commute from Eugene and other outlying areas. Other universities do pay more for transit because they receive regional transportation services. The City of Corvallis transit system only operates within city boundaries. HB 3002 would not expand this service. Currently, less than three-fourths of our employees live within the city boundaries. Unlike students and staff at the U of O and PSU, a significant number of our students' employees would not receive transit service even if OSU were assessed a payroll tax. OSU needs to provide parking regardless of whether the city requires it or not. Corvallis has estimated that parking for the OSU Alumni Center cost OSU between $805,000 and $1.1 million. It is stated that these costs would not have been required had HB 3002 been in effect when that building was approved by the city. In fact, the construction of parking associated with the Alumni Center cost only $361,000. More importantly, these costs would have been necessary regardless of city parking requirements. The Alumni Center serves as a significant meeting place for statewide functions and organizations. The people using the Alumni Center travel from throughout the state and beyond for these purposes. They need parking regardless of whether the city required it or not, and regardless of the local transit services provided by the city. OSU wants an equitable system to pay for transit service. We would like to resolve our differences locally. Under HB 3002, we estimate the city would receive over $1.6 million each biennium from OSU to pay for local transit if this tax were applied to auxiliary and education and general fund salaries. If it was also applied to statewide salaries of employees assigned to the Corvallis campus, an additional $250,000 would be required. Not once has this possible transfer payment and increase in costs been reviewed or considered by the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee, which is currently developing the higher education budget. This bill will significantly increase our costs at a time while the co-chairs are currently planning some $70 million in reductions to the Oregon University System budget. From our perspective, this action amounts to nothing more than an unfunded mandate and one that we cannot afford in the current economic climate. The effect of this bill will be a real and immediate reduction in services for your constituents and fewer classes and services for Oregon State University students who are already facing significant increases in tuition. Secondly, the bill would greatly shift the balance. By our estimation, OSU would pay for two-thirds or more of the Corvallis Transit System's current costs, even though we account for only 40% of the ridership. We believe there is a fair solution to this problem. We don't believe that the solution is found in HB 3002. I thank you for considering Oregon State University's perspective and would be willing to answer any questions.
Well, I can tell you about the parking in OSU is I've never gone down there to speak that I have not ended up having a parking ticket. So trust me, when you're 5 minutes over the time you're supposed to start to speak and you can't find a parking place and you park where you think, well, I hope this works, and it doesn't, you certainly have a problem with parking down there. Any questions? Let me ask one question here that I had, and that is, would you in fact change any operations of your van operations to move employees in? It sounds that you wouldn't because it'd be outside that service area. The van operation that's mentioned.
The campus shuttle program that we have?
No, I think it was employee van. I'm looking for it right now.
Oh, van pool.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
Right, right. Would you change any operations? Would you be able to end that operation if, in fact, you were paying the fees and Corvallis and was able to, would they be able to deliver that service for you? Would not. Okay. Very good. Any further questions? Representative Hanson.
Well, yeah, you've alluded to the fact that this could be worked out locally. Is there any way that this committee could help encourage or facilitate that process?
Please give us your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson, Jock Mills, Director of Government Relations for Oregon State University. The solution really lies in the appropriation that we get through the higher education budget. That's where our budget would come from. And so what we have told the city in terms of negotiations, in terms of the amount that would be transferred from OSU to encourage ridership on the Corvallis system, is based on what our bottom line appropriation coming out of this session is. So if we're facing further reductions in our budget, our ability to raise the amount of money going to the city through our appropriations would be less than if our budget were similar to what it was last biennium. We've already gone through a number of reductions during the current biennium, and we're not looking at a very favorable budget situation for the next biennium. So it's really in your hands in terms of how much you appropriate to the university system and what comes through to Oregon State University.
I don't think that's quite the answer that I wanted. If we just, you're proposing that in this testimony that it's a local issue that could be resolved locally. I don't think that means that the state legislature is going to get involved in terms of allocating the amount of money that we think is necessary to solve the problem. But I think we need local discussions. One, in terms of what that, for example, you say, this bill would shift the balance with OSU, would pay two-thirds for Corvallis' transit system when you only account for 40%. Is there a solution out there where you'd be paying 40% of their transportation? I mean, I think we need to get some negotiations coming out of between OSU and Corvallis, and then whether that's a cost that would be absorbed by the university system or whether I don't know what the answer is, and I'd like to see an answer coming from Corvallis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, there are conceivably tools which we could use locally. One item, for example, is in fees that we assess for parking, in applying a surcharge or some other tool to that and then use those revenues raised and pass those through to the city. We haven't engaged in that discussion, and we have set our fees already for parking for next year. We need to do that on a time schedule so students know what it is they're looking at, and also what the faculty. And frankly, we have significantly increased our parking fees by double for next year to try and deal with just the cost of parking on campus and the anticipation of new facilities. So there's some pressure, there's some constraints there. But I believe there are some local solutions which we could work through that wouldn't necessarily require additional general fund appropriations to the university to resolve those problems.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, going just where Representative Hansen had gone, I think there's a lot of room for you people to take time to take your differences and meet and sit down and have a cup of coffee and find a solution. I'm not certain that this should be coming to us to start with to try to solve a local issue here. I don't like dealing with it.
Has there been any discussion? It would appear to me, looking at the numbers, that it's a very small percentage of the actual cost of the system is borne by the fare box. To me, that is, without question, the most equitable way to generate revenue for any system. When we had private systems, it was 100% fare box. And we're looking at Portland right now with collecting almost $200 million from taxpayers to operate a system outside of the fare box. Has there been any discussion about actually doing it, handling the funding that way?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for raising that. I should have raised that with regard to Representative Hansen's question. At one point in the discussions with the city, right now our students and faculty and staff ride for free based on the transactions that we've outlined for you. One possibility would be a differential fare. In other words, that those who are OSU employees could pay a smaller fare than what would be charged for other Corvallis citizens to ride based on the transfer of payment. We have raised a number of those opportunities to the city, and that would be another alternative. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you, too. At this time, I see Roger Martin has arrived. Let's ask Martin to come over. Also, we have Ms. Hellenberg here. Okay, why don't you come on up too, Helen?
Good Good morning, Chair George and members of the committee. My name is Helen Berg, and I'm the mayor of the city of Corvallis. And I thank you for this opportunity to provide information regarding transit service in Oregon and to request your support for the passage of 3002. This is a matter of equity. Transit service in Oregon is provided by a variety of entities representing different types of governing structures. There are mass transit districts, and Chair George referred to that in TriMet in Portland. There's also Lane Transit in the Eugene Springfield area and Salem area transit. Now, another form is the transportation district. I spoke of mass transit. This is transportation districts. These include Basin Transit in Klamath Falls, Rogue Valley Transit in the Medford area, Sunset Empire in the Astoria area, and Hood River Transit District, and there are others. Now, transit service is also provided by cities, such as in Albany and Corvallis, Philomath, Lebanon, Wilsonville, Bend, Woodburn, and a few others. Now, all these agencies, districts, and cities provide bus service to the general public, and yet cities are treated differently by the state. Only mass transit districts and transportation districts are eligible to receive compensation for the transit service they provide to state agencies. Now, currently, ORS 291.405 provides transit funding to mass transit districts and transportation districts through an assessment on state payroll within the area served by the transit. It is built into each state agency's payroll expenses. It was put in place by the legislature to compensate transit providers for the transit service that state agencies receive. And unfortunately, at the time the assessment was created, only the mass transit districts and the transportation districts were recognized as transit providers, and therefore transit districts receive state funding and are able to provide a higher level of transit service than non-districts can provide. Additionally, state agencies paying the assessment are exempt, as Councillor Warshall pointed out, from any city parking code requirements for state buildings in that transit service area, and that was considered to be some kind of quid pro quo. Now, the proposed legislation, HB 3002, would amend the law, ORS 291.405 through 407, to create equity among all the governing bodies providing transit service to state agencies to the extent that the local communities support transit service. And let me emphasize that, because that is a limitation. Only communities willing to support transit through their local tax dollars are eligible for this revenue. Corvallis has been directly serving state facilities, including Oregon State University, with transit services in Corvallis since 1981. And we're very proud of that. We're a small city to be able to do that. And yet we have not received in lieu of tax compensation for the service. By contrast, Layton Transit District, which serves the University of Oregon campus and other state agencies in the Eugene Springfield area, receives over $1 million annually from the state to help pay for transit service in the district. But please note that both the university and the Associated Students of Oregon State University do reimburse the city for a ride-free program, just showing their ID for faculty, staff, and students. But you note correctly, Chair George, that fares only cover about 10% of the cost of the system. It's a very careful balance. You start charging too much, you lose riders, and we are always very conscious of this. I had an economist tell me once that the only city in the world that can support its public transit system from the fare box is Hong Kong. So there's a certain density that's required. The University of Oregon does have this kind of fare program in addition to their larger payroll assessment, and they do it at a much higher level. This is a regional issue, As has been pointed out, most of the transit districts provide service to a regional area. The City of Corvallis recognizes this need, and we have developed regional partners. This is accomplished through effective intergovernmental agreements. We contribute funds to the operation of the Lynn-Benton Loop. That's Corvallis, the community college in Albany, and at the university. And this loop provides a huge economic benefit to OSU, since many lower division classes do not have to be offered at OSU and can be provided through a dual enrollment program at Lynn-Benton. The City of Corvallis also contributes to the Philomath Connection by providing transit staff services and operating their operations and maintenance contract through our contract. Passage of 3002 would benefit these regional transit services. My final point has to do with efficiency. We operate transit service through the city because we believe for our region it is the most efficient means to provide the service. By providing it ourselves, we cut out a level of government. We do not have additional administrative expenses associated with the formation and operation of a separate district. Corvallis, over our 22 years of history, our record now, we provide one of the lowest cost per ride in the state. And we also compare favorably with the large transit providers in the number of rides per hour of the service that we provide. The proposed legislation would provide equity for transit providers and result in equity for state facilities served by transit. We have also submitted for your consideration a letter from Mayor McLaren from the City of Albany. I would like to refer to one bit of testimony yesterday when the gentleman representing the tribal interests in Umatilla County was talking in favor of his point of view. He used the phrase that we haven't asked as firmly as we should. And perhaps I think that applies to the situation in Corvallis that you urge us to resolve together. Let me assure you, we have been trying on both sides to do that for about 10 years. But we would ask for your support, and thank you very much for this opportunity.
Question for the mayor, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Helen, for coming as well. Has there been any consideration for the Mid Valley to create a transportation district that would move it into the auspices of existing statutes? And if so,
yes,
what would be the impacts on Oregon State if that were to happen?
We are in continual communication with our neighbors. We talk about whether that would be a transit district that was something smaller than Benton County or all of Benton County, or should it be Lynn and Benton County or Lynn, Benton and Lincoln County. The citizens of Corvallis have for 22 years been very faithfully voting for levies specifically for transit. Many more people vote for property taxes than ride the bus. But since Measure 4750, we can't do the things that way, and it's been rolled into our general fund. But once you begin providing mass transit for a larger area, the number of taxpayers decreases even more rapidly than the costs rise to provide that service at a greater distance. So it's possible, but it's going to take a lot of support outside Corvallis, and that would have to be carefully built.
Helen, we're really concerned right now in this building with the fact that we have an economy that's the worst in the nation. We're talking about almost $2 million increase in cost to the university in Corvallis, and without question, an increase in taxes to the citizens of Corvallis. Can you rationalize that as the mayor of a city that has economic troubles also?
Well, I'm sure you know that those of us in public office never rationalize. But
I think that's how we're supposed to get there.
But I do appreciate the question, Chairman George, because there are limits on the funding that is recommended in this legislation. First of all, the statute would limit the amount of funding a state agency can be assessed to 0.6% of the total amount of wages generated within the transit service area. Now, we assume that Oregon State University is already paying this assessment for OSU employees located in existing transit districts, for example, in Lincoln County and other areas with OSU outreach programs and served by a transit district. And they would be doing that according to ORS 291.4052D. But secondly, the assessment cannot be more than the amount the city of Corvallis generated under the city's own taxes for transit service during the immediately preceding fiscal year. So this is also specified. Now, the amount of locally generated taxes does not include amounts received from other sources, for example, the fare box or the federal government. And in 2003 and 4, the city of Corvallis' own tax amount dedicated to transit service has been $849,000. That's almost half of the figure that I'm afraid OSU is thinking they might be responsible for. So there are these two limits. Now, you asked me if this is a time to be increasing allocations to transit. Of course, in the city of Corvallis,
taxes on the citizens of Corvallis.
Yeah, we are not proposing raising property taxes for transit, at least at the present time. What puzzles us is how did it happen that the funding that is parallel, for example, at the University of Oregon and Portland State University, was not, I think, charged to the university. I think when that legislation passed, that money was allocated along with the legislation. Have I answered your question? Without rationalizing.
Thank you. Roger Martin.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is Roger Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Transit Association. I took my Ritalin this morning, so I'll be calm.
Well, I was ready to say, okay, Roger, no more attacks on the committee. You'll be asked to leave. So I was prepared whether you had your Ritalin.
I'd like to give you a little background on the history of this because I've been here that long. I chaired an interim committee in 1969 that created the various statutes under which the transit bodies in the state of Oregon operate. We gave the option to those communities that had a transit district. At that time, it was Eugene and Portland area, TriMet and Lane Transit, a list of various revenues they could go to the voters or vote in. And they chose the payroll tax. It has had some controversy in the past. Employers early on were avidly opposed to it. They've come to realize that it serves them well in many cases, and we have some very strong supporters in those areas. But the payroll tax was charged only to private employers. None of the government agencies paid for it. In 1978, Governor Victor Attia was elected. One of the first things he did was say, you know, it's a little unfair. If you look at who rides transit, government employees are large participants, government employees, other people that are connected with government, and yet we contribute nothing to it. And he brought to the legislature a program to say we're going to have an in lieu of payroll tax, we're going to assess it on state government. Later on, that was extended to cities and to counties. The only people that don't pay it are the federal government, because unfortunately we can't tax the federal government. We would if we could, but we can't. And so for 20 years, the University of Oregon, Portland State University, Portland State University, Southern Oregon University, Oregon Technical Institute have all paid this, and it comes, it was not appropriated ever. It's embedded in their overall cost of the running the universities. University of Oregon pays something like $1 million a biennium towards the operational lane transit. It's in recognition that about 50% of everybody that rides the bus in Lane County are connected, either students or connected to the university. Cities have been excluded, not by any evil thing, but by an oversight at first. We've tried for 10 years to include them. And I have to compliment Oregon State University. At least we're doing this now in public testimony. They've just sabotaged the bill for the last 10 years underground without anybody even knowing about it. And Senator Morris asked the question, have we ever tried to form a transit district? Yes, we tried to form a transportation district several sessions ago. That got torpedoed also. The vice president from Oregon State testified that they currently give about $80,000 to Corvallis, but 40% of the riders are students or members of the faculty. The budget is $1.5 million, so 40%, they ought to be paying about $600,000, and you can see the difference there. But beyond just this argument that goes on in Benton County between Oregon State University and Corvallis and the rest of us, there are 15 other cities in the state who are prevented because this statute always gets plugged by Corvallis or by the argument in Benton County. They range from Albany, Astoria, Bend, communities all over that cannot charge any kind of an in lieu of payroll tax to anybody because we can't get cities included under the statute. I would hope you would seriously consider, nobody has any doubts that Oregon State and every other institution is going to have financial problems. We don't recognize that. Perhaps the solution to that is pass it and phase it in over a couple of biennium. Bernadette Barrett, who runs the Corvallis Transit System, is sitting here. She's been a long-time board member of the Oregon Transit Association, one of the most capable people on our board, has done wonderful things for transit systems all over. I think Bernadette and I would agree right now, if you can't pass it in total, pass it partially. But let's get off this dime of stopping it dead, because I don't think it's fair. Just by equity, if the other major institutions in the state have been paying this for 20 years, why do we just give a pass to Oregon State every year? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Andrea Vogel, have Andrea come up. And then, Martin, if you want to go ahead and come up. Yeah, Martin's here. Good.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Andrea Fogg with the League of Oregon Cities. Quickly this morning, I would just like to express on behalf of the League our support for House Bill 3002. You have heard that this is a critical issue for the city of Corvallis, but you've also heard there are approximately other 15 other cities across the state that would benefit from addressing this equity issue and allowing them to be treated as other transit agencies are today. And with that, I'd answer any questions. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair George, committee members. Martin Loring, administrator of ODOT's Public Transit Division. It just seems like just yesterday I was here testifying before you. Oh, gosh, I guess it was. A number of major points have been touched on. I'm just going to hit the highlights. Initially, this was characterized as a local dispute that was brought to the legislature. With respect to my university colleagues, this is not a local dispute. This is a state public policy issue. When the legislature created the Mass Transit Assessment Program in 1981, it identified public transit by the organizational forms in which public transit was provided then. That included mass transit assessment or mass transit districts and transportation districts, as prior people have testified. That was 24 years ago. Corvallis started providing bus service 22 years ago. The bill didn't know that. Of the 16 municipal corporations around the state that provide some sort of public transit service today, to the best of my knowledge, I believe none of them were providing that bus service in 1981. So the public policy concept that you enshrined in that statute was that state agencies derive an economic benefit from having a bus available to get their employees to and from work. but that these transportation services are supported by local taxes, property taxes or payroll taxes, which the state does not pay. So this was established as an in lieu of tax way to help the state recognize the benefit that it receives from this local service. So as the mayor said, it is an equity issue. Other people in other contexts have said timing is everything. It is very unfortunate that this equity issue, this important public policy issue, is presented to you at a time of unprecedented economic distress for the state. There may be a way to address that in the current statute. The fiscal impacts have been estimated at 0.6%. The Department of Administrative Services administers this program, and what the statute tells them to do is assess up to 0.6%. So they have within their discretion to phase it in or do something other than the 0.6, as long as they don't exceed it. There's also language in the statute that essentially says that economic distress may be a reason not to pay the assessment, even to an otherwise eligible jurisdiction. So the statute has provided scope for the Department of Administrative Services to reflect economic conditions in their administration of this statute, if you choose to go that way.
Or has there ever been a time when they actually did exercise those two provisions?
Chair George, not to my knowledge.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
That really concludes my testimony. We'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Yes, Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can they exercise that on a case-by-case basis? Could they do it like by city by city, or would it be uniform?
Chair George, Representative Hanson, again, I'm not a lawyer. All I can do is read plain text of statute and apply my layman's judgment as to what I think that might mean. I've discovered in life lawyers don't always read those words the same way that a layperson reads them.
We would appreciate it if everyone would read it the way you read it.
what the plain language says is the Oregon Department of Administrative Services shall not assess more from an agency than the Legislative Assembly provides the agency for the purposes of this section, either directly or indirectly through its approval of budgets or through the Emergency Board if the agency budget is approved by the Legislative Assembly from general fund monies.
Any further questions? Senator Morris.
Would this discussion look any differently if the authority to assess these the payroll was against the employee as opposed to the employer?
Chair George, Senator Morris, that's an interesting question to which I don't have much of an answer.
It seems to me that we just, with respect to public agencies, we just transfer upstream the responsibility to the whole state for a specific service to a specific region. And I, being new to this, I wonder the logic of doing that.
It's called deep pockets.
Well, they used to be deep pockets, but not anymore.
Yeah. Well, they're deep pockets. There's just nothing in there anymore.
Empty
deep pockets. Excuse me, you guys.
Chair George, Senator Morse. The only thing there is something we're working with the Department of Administrative Services on, called the Federal Commuter Choice Initiative, which would allow any employee, public or private sector, to pay for bus passes or the cost of vanpool services with pre-tax dollars, or it would allow that employer, public or private sector, to pay to actually pay that as an untaxed benefit. The Department of Administrative Service has bargained that issue with unions representing state employees and is moving to implement it on a pre-tax basis, that is to say to allow employees to use their own money to pay for bus passes but do so on a pre-tax basis. That's the closest thing I can come to the question you raised, sir.
Any further questions for Martin? We have completed our list of folks who would like to testify, but is there anyone else in the audience who would like to speak to House Bill 3002? If not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3002. And with a quorum present, we're going to open a public hearing. And what we're going to do is, because they are related, is to have consideration of Senate Bill 468, SJR 14, and House Bill 3187.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 468A transfers from the Department of Transportation the duties and functions and powers relating to title and registration of manufactured structures to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Replaces the manufactured title and registration system with an ownership document that would be a new document within DCBS. Allows the cancellation of this so that structures can be recorded and assessed as real property on the deed records. Transfers ODOT's authority over vehicle dealers dealing in manufactured structures to DCBS. And this transfer becomes effective July 1, 2004. There are two sets of amendments in your pile.
It's a lengthy
bill. It's about 130 pages. The dash two amendments make further substantive revisions, allows ODOT to retain certain records in the case of having vehicle dealers that relate to actual vehicles and manufactured structures. Allows owners that own a structure and has a leasehold of 20 years or more to record the structure on the county deed records. Provides certain exceptions to vehicle dealers and establishes certain licensing of dealers. It's quite lengthy. I think it's probably best to turn it over to the experts that are wanting to go with this bill. And the dash 8.3s are conflict amendments with two other bills, but are not substantive.
They're conflict amendments.
And there are no fiscal associated with the dash 8.3s.
Well, good, because I was afraid we were creating conflict.
Well, we might. We haven't got there yet. I will tell you before we get too far into this, the fiscal impact has not been completed yet. LFO is working with the two agencies that would be swapping this program and trying to refine those numbers and work out some cash flow issues before we come forward with a formal recommendation to the committee.
Okay. At this time, let's call up Don Miner and Diane Belt. Oh, is that right? Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in support of Senate Bill 468 with the dash 2 amendments, SJR 14, and House Bill 3187. And I also want to thank you for allowing us to come before you today. These three measures comprise a package of legislation, as your staff has told you, that transfers authority to regulate, to title and register manufactured homes and to regulate manufactured home dealers from DMV to the Building Codes Division. Even after this, if this transfer occurs, ODOT will still retain authority to regulate the movement of overdimensional loads on the road. So that part is unaffected. For as long as anyone can remember, DMV has regulated manufactured homes. They regulated trailer houses, then mobile homes, and now manufactured homes. And for as long as I can remember, people have been asking, why are houses regulated DMV?
I have a license plate on my home.
Yeah, that's a. And actually, for as long as I can remember, as long as I've been here, which goes back to about 79, our association had always opposed this move. Even though others had supported it, and we have changed our position on this. We think it's a very logical thing to do and probably will produce a lot of benefit. During the 2001 regular session of the legislature, then Representative Bruce Starr had brought this question up, but it was not enough time during the session. It was too complex, as you can see from the legislation with its amendments, to do something in that period of time. So the House Interim Committee Transportation Committee appointed a task force to look at alternatives to having DMV title and regulate manufactured homes. That task force included industry, government, consumers. The Department of Revenue was there, title companies, recorders, county assessors, ourselves, and others. And 468 is the result of that effort. Now, the question that is reasonable to ask is, why should this go from DMV to BCD? I have given you a handout. It's a disclosure that's prepared by the Department of Justice, and all manufactured home dealers, as a matter of law, are required to give this to consumers. And it's a roadmap to help consumers navigate their way through the various governmental agencies that they can turn to for help. And you'll see the first highlighted column is the BCD, basically, DCBS, the Building Codes Division. And so it identifies types of issues that consumers can have and how BCD can help them. You also see that DMV is listed there. You'll notice Building Codes Division does just about everything related to manufactured housing. They're an agent of the federal government. They regulate the construction of these homes and the plants. As part of that duty, they maintain a database of manufactured homes. They respond to consumer complaints relating to the construction and installation of manufactured homes. They regulate the people that install manufactured homes. They have authority to require that dealers correct problems related to the installation of the homes. They have authority to resolve disputes between consumers. But they don't have authority if those disputes go to the sales process of the home. Consolidation of these two programs will make government more efficient, and we think it will be helpful to consumers by giving them more of a one-stop shopping, although you can see it still won't be one-stop. And it'll be easier for them to navigate their way. Also, we think a benefit of this will be the combining of the two databases, the DMV's database with Building Codes database. Now, they're not identical databases. BCD tracks the homes as they're built. I believe they track them through the dealer and know whom the home was sold to. But they don't record lien and title information. This bill would give BCD that authority. This, we believe, will help county assessors. Diane can speak more to that, but help them keep track of homes for purposes of taxation and might even save somebody some money, or at least that would be our hope. We also think that it will give both the industry and consumers better service. There are about, and I'm probably low, but about 10,000 manufactured home transactions a year at DMV. And they do out of a million plus transactions that they do. So you can imagine that they don't have a lot of time to focus on this area. Also, manufactured home transactions are somewhat unique, particularly the detitling process that allows them to be converted from vehicles into real estate. So it doesn't fit very well. If this measure passes, manufactured homes simply won't be vehicles any longer. However, most existing procedures relating to the way they're moved, their title, et cetera, will still continue, so there won't be a lot of upset there. Instead of the title, the homeowner will get an ownership document. Lenders will record their interest against that home ownership document in BCD records as opposed to recording their interest against a title at DMV, but the legal significance is intended to remain unchanged. BCD has talked about developing an internet-based system so that many of the transactions can be processed electronically. The bill gives counties authority to do the titling work for homes that have been previously titled that are in the system. And we're hoping they'll be able to access that through the internet as well. Dealers will transfer home or title homes that are new. If the county or the dealer refuse to do it or are unwilling to do it, the consumer can do it themselves through the state. Part of the package of bills that came out of the Senate committee included Senate Bill 690. That would have changed the way dealers are regulated at DMV, although it transferred that authority to BCD. After that bill was referred to this committee, DCBS began to have misgivings about supporting that bill. It required that they develop a licensing system, an education system for salespeople. And taking this job on, the titling and that, was probably more than was reasonable to ask of them. So that bill isn't going to go forward, and it's not before you today. However, there were some important provisions in that bill, such as creating a limited license for people, mobile home park owners who sell homes in their parks. So rather than amending Senate Bill 690 by deleting the things that folks didn't want and bringing that to you, what we would ask is that, well, what we did was developed an amendment, took the things out of Senate Bill 690 that people wanted, and tried to bring them and put them into this bill. The goal is to eliminate need for conflict amendments, make things a little more reasonable so folks can see up front what the legislation will require. So accordingly, we would request that you adopt those amendments. I've also, before you also is SGR 14. That's a measure that amends the Constitution. Not much of an amendment, deletes one word, but it removes the, well, there's some questions to whether manufactured home fees. Clearly mobile home fees go into the highway fund. What this does is just make clear that none of those fees go to the highway fund, that in fact those fees can be given to Building Codes Division to carry out their responsibilities. Also, you have a House Bill 3187. That was our effort to provide voters with an explanation of what a vote, their yes vote, would mean. We didn't want to leave that to chance. I gave you a copy of the original House Bill 3187 that says that if you vote yes, that taxes and fees on mobile homes could be used for any purpose. Now, we assume that would include pizza parties. be kidding. But, you know, it's probably, well, you can see why we didn't want to leave it to chance. As amended, House Bill 3187 simply says that the fees can be used for non-highway purposes. As a matter of statute and the way 468 is structured, those fees can only be used for manufactured home purposes, so the pizza was off the table in any event. So, you know, with that, I will conclude my remarks and request your support.
Questions for Don? Senator Dukes.
What would happen if we passed 468 and the public didn't pass the ballot measure to change the Constitution?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, probably not a good authority on how the Constitution works, but my guess would be that ODOT would always be in the position of being required to look over the shoulders of BCD to make sure that they spent every dime appropriately and looking for money that they could pull back into the highway fund. That's probably the consequence of that.
And I'm sure ODOT will correct me when they come to the table later, potentially. It's our understanding that if the voters do not pass it or those two bills don't leave the legislative assembly, that the language within the Constitution as it relates to these fees now are permissive, that fees for the manufactured homes can be used for the administration of the program first and foremost. Anything that is in excess of that currently could be sent to the highway fund or parks as an allowable use. And in fact, Parks and Recreation does receive a portion of the excess revenues over costs. But if this doesn't pass, if those companion pieces don't pass, as long as the surplus revenues are held for the purposes of administration of that fund, then we're fine. We just can't spend them on anything else. If they were to be spent on anything else, then they would have to be used for one of those constitutional purposes. But it could be used to expand the program or, you know, make modifications for administration of the manufactured program structure.
I didn't look at the constitutional amendment, but I assume it's not as simple as us simply defining by statute that a mobile home is not really a mobile home, that it's not a vehicle, because the Constitution requires that things related to motor vehicles in any way, shape, or form go into the trust fund. But, I mean, I don't know whoever came up with the the title mobile home, but and I guess maybe at one time they did, but I don't know. They sure as heck don't anymore. I mean, there's
axles are gone, hitches are gone.
There's no motor, there's no steering wheel, there's no accelerator. Be pretty tough to drive down the road.
Well, Mr. Senator Dukes, one of the ideas that the task force considered was just simply changing the definition. But, of course, the Constitution, or we changed the definition in statute, but the Constitution trumps statutes. And so
Constitution lists mobile homes?
It says mobile home.
No.
And it's my understanding it's whatever mobile home was whenever it was written, which...
So if we call them something else, could they not be mobile homes?
Well, there's some doubt as to whether that solves it. This seems to be the cleaner way.
I just know that the public doesn't often change that particular section of the Constitution, although they are asked to periodically.
Any further questions for Don? Thanks, Don. Diane?
Okay. Thank you very much, committee members. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Diane Belt. I represent the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, and I am also employed by Washington County. I've been in this business now for almost 25 years. And to answer your question about when this all started, back in 1972 is when manufactured housing came to the tax rolls. Prior to that time, they were licensed and registered through the Department of Motor Vehicles. They were called mobile homes, and they were very mobile at that time. We actually still have on our tax rolls homes that do go back into the late 60s, so there are still some out there. I think everybody talks about if the system isn't broke, why fix it? Well, this is just an example of why we need to fix it. This is a printout from the Department of Motor Vehicles. This is volume 1 of 4. These are the homes that we cannot locate in our county. Now, I don't know if somebody in our office has stock in Post-it notes or what, but they have depleted my supply. And I'm sure some of these we will find are probably real property, or we'll track them down. But that's just so you know that, yes, there is a problem, and we do need to look at how this works. I would really like
to... Are you sure they're not mobile?
Yes. They can be moved. They can be moved. The new ones, now it's a little more difficult, but yes, they can be moved. But you can also move a house if you have to, too. I really would like to thank the committee for hearing this bill. It's been... we've been working on this bill now for almost 18 months or this process. I'd like to thank now Senator Bruce Starr for calling this group together. At first, it was one of these things where I think I'm like Don, you know, well, it's been this way forever. Why are we messing with it? And let's leave it alone. And I think the more that we sat down and started talking about it, the more we realized that this is why we need to change the system. We deal with the customers on a daily basis that come into our office to do a lot of the paperwork that's needed to transfer ownership on these homes, and they can't understand why they have to go to the Department of Motor Vehicles because, you know, it doesn't have wheels, and yet by law they're required to display that license plate in their window somewhere. It's been a great opportunity to work on this and to look at the problems. I think what we were looking for as far as the county is concerned is a streamlined process that works for our constituents, which are our customers, the taxpayers, and also work for the county, because the way the system works now, it doesn't work for the county very well. After we really sat down and started analyzing, I think in the early years when the homes were truly mobile and they actually moved from site to site, it was easy for a farmer to hook on with a tractor and pull them around. We needed to probably have a better tracking system, DMV, with their trip permits and that kind of stuff was in place at that time. But you can't move them that way anymore. They are people's homes. Our structure group met several times. Our first meeting was on March the 20th, and as Don said, there were a lot of members from all of the folks that were involved in this process, title companies, lenders, collectors, assessors, the clerk's office. They also get involved with this process. Park owners, tenants, and DCBS, and I was and Building Codes Division. I was quite surprised when the gentleman from Building Codes was talking to us about how much they knew about the manufactured home before it actually went to the the site. And it's like, well, we have the other piece of the picture. And he has everything that we'd like to know, because we've never had a database that actually tracks these homes, because it's all volunteer on the consumer to provide us with the information on their home, because it's not recorded in our county records. So we've never really been able to establish a good database on these homes and find out sales price and how the industry is working. So this system will actually do that for us. When somebody comes in to transfer ownership on a manufactured home, they walk out the door with a piece of paper, and you cross your fingers that they go down to DMV and transfer, because if they don't, it does not happen. And with taxes, when you don't pay your taxes on personal property because you don't own the land, we issue a judgment or a warrant against that home, which kind of mucks up your credit. So if that person doesn't go out there and transfer the home, the person that sold that home, and the taxes didn't get paid, that person now has a judgment recorded against them for delinquent taxes on a home that they sold. They did everything right, except that the purchaser of that home did not follow the process. This solves that problem. It also solves the problem of the county waiting 6 to 8 weeks for the information to come back to us to update our records. The Department of Motor Vehicles sends us a copy of the registration to show that the transaction had completed. Once somebody under this process, once somebody comes into our counter to do a transfer or conduct business, when they walk out the door, that process is completed and we are able to update our records. So it's a benefit to the consumer, because our information will be current. We won't have this problem. We will be able to deal with that problem. The citizens will be better served, and the county will, because it's going to cut a lot of our paperwork out, and it's going to have a streamlined system, and we're going to treat these people like homeowners, not trailer owners. And I listed what I feel the advantages are. We just talked about a lot of them. By the process, we're not changing our laws. We're not changing the way we collect the taxes. We're not changing the way we assess the property. We're just making this more like real property, more like a stick-built home, which I think is these people deserve that, because this is their home. So let's get it out of the motor vehicle system. Let's move it over where it belongs. At first, I think the counties were a little bit apprehensive, but the more we talked about these problems and the more we talked about the workflow, we realized this is the way it has to be. And I really encourage you to look this over. I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions for Diane? Senator Morris.
This volume one of four, does that represent units that are not paid?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, possibly. What we will do once we identify all the homes, and I have another book just like this that's the county records that also has a lot of tags on it. They're homes that we have that they don't. There's possible that some of these homes are not on the tax roll. It's also possible that some of these homes we have picked up on a real property account and they're being taxed that way, so they didn't go through the exemption process properly. They also could be homes that are not in our county anymore that have left and they didn't get the right documentation to leave. So until we actually sit down and analyze this data, it's hard to say. But I suspect that, yes, there probably are some homes out there that we do not have on our tax rolls. That is very possible, yes.
Diane, it just seems like yesterday, but it was a revenue committee a few years ago. Remember, we went through this.
Yes.
And an attempt to, and it was a shock to me to have recognized how much trouble this was for a county attempting to, you know, assess property.
Oh, yeah. So, Mr. Chair, and that was a good bill. It solved a lot of problems, too. Now we just need to take it a little further. Now the next piece.
Okay. Any further questions? Thanks. Very helpful, you two.
Thank you.
But this time we have Senator Bruce Starr here. And, Pat, if you would come on up, too, at the same time, Pat Swa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, State Senator Bruce Starr, Senate District 15, Washington County. I'm just here to support Senate Bill 468. In a way, I feel like I have a little piece of ownership in this, in that last session, having conversations with Kelly Taylor from DMV, we talked about the fact that DMV regulates, you know, manufactured homes. And it goes back, obviously, to when they were mobile homes and on wheels, and they were actually mobile to a certain extent. And I told her that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense at all that DMV regulates and regulates license and all these things for manufactured homes. And she said, "You're right, it doesn't. Can you help me?" And I suggested that perhaps a work group get put together. And in a large respect, what you see in Senate Bill 468 is the result of that work group. And some of the members of the folks that came together weren't real sure they wanted to change. This, you know, the system seemed to be working fine. But at the end of the day, I think everybody around the table recognized that it was a good move. They worked really hard over a period of months coming together and working out the problems or perceived problems and finding solutions to them. And I want to give a lot of credit to those that worked. You've heard testimony so far, and you will hear more from those that have done that. And I think what it is, it's a recognition, as you've heard, that these aren't mobile homes anymore. They are manufactured homes. They're where people live. They generally don't get wheels put under them again and again and again. And I think this is a proper thing to do, the right thing to do, makes sense. Urge the committee to send the bill on to the House and Senate floor for action. Thank you very much.
Yes, for the record, my name is Pat Schwach, and I represent Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon. We talk about the people who live in these, and I happen to be one of those people who lives in one of them. An interesting thing that I need to throw out to you happened just this very day to me. A member called in, and he said, "I've been given an eviction for no cause. And I live in a manufactured house." And so we had a small conversation about it. And I said, "Well, if you live in a manufactured home, you can't be given a no-cause eviction." So I finally said to him, "Where do you live?" So he told me where, and I won't discuss where it is. And I said, "How big is your mobile home?" He said, 30 feet. And I said, "We've got a small problem here. You live in an RV. You don't live in a manufactured home. And yes, in an RV, you may be evicted for no cause." Well, anyway, he was trying to figure out how to stretch his house. And I kept saying to him, "How big is this thing? Can you tow it behind your car?" "Well, yes." And I said, "Well, you can't live in a mobile home because you can't tow one of those anymore." Well, anyway, sorry. But this is something that I feel is really important. And we've discussed it with some of our members. And the comment has been, "Oh, gee, you mean I'm not going to be an automobile anymore and have a certificate of title?" So I think it's a wonderful thing. And it was a pleasure to work on this. And I certainly do commend Senator Starr for beginning to get the process on this. It's great. Thank you.
Pat, you would appreciate this. Many years ago, we had someone ask, "Why do you have a license plate in your front window?" And I said, "Oh, I have a further collection in my back room."
Yeah, it'd be nice to get rid of those.
In your window.
Thank you.
Thanks, you too. At this time, I think it would be very helpful to have Carrie Thompson come up from DCBS and also Kelly Taylor. We can kind of see how everyone thinks about this.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Just while they're coming up, if I could make a comment, something that seems this simple and this common sense, I think everybody involved should get a real thank you for the incredible amount of work that it takes to make a change like this. This is government at its finest, that when you build in a system in place for 30 or 40 years, to make this type of a change takes an incredible amount of work, and I think everybody that worked on it deserves to a level of thank you from us, because there's an awful lot of complicated details before we ever get this far along the process.
Maybe a minute of clapping for every page of the bill.
No amendments.
Go ahead. For the record, I'm Carrie Thompson, the Department of Consumer and Business Services Budget Manager. Senator George, members of the committee, I'm here to testify to the fact that I'm working closely with Department of Transportation and LFO staff to determine the actual revenue transfers. That's been one of my concerns, the timing of those revenue transfers, the exact amount, so that we can ensure that customer delivery of service is not going to be interrupted as a result of this change in program. If the legislature wills it to come to building codes and the Department of Consumer and Business Services, we wanted to ensure that the customer delivery is not going to be interrupted.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Tater with the Department of Transportation. And this is, Mr. Miner, and Ms. Belt is correct. I mean, this is something that's been talked about on and off for 15 years or more. And this is the furthest it's come. And frankly, I think it's because we had all the players around the table the whole time. Every piece of it that we could find, and urge people to come and work through it and work through the issues. And I want you to know that we are committed to working with DCBS to make it a smooth transition, to give them all the staff help we can, and which is what we've done as the bill is drafted. You know, if we saw that they were heading down a path that we thought would be cumbersome, we'd say, hey, you could probably streamline it this way or whatever, because we know the business now. But I'll tell you, you know, Don's right. It gets lost among the millions and millions of cars we do to do a handful of homes, and the paperwork is slightly different, especially when it's being made real property. We're looking at tax lot forms and things we don't even know what we're looking at. And to try to keep folks up to speed on that when they're really dealing mostly with driver licensing and vehicle licensing, it's difficult. And so, yes, mistakes do get made. And we've really felt bad through the years that the customer, the person out there, the Pat Schwachs of the world, are being shuttled from you know, us to the county, to the dealer, back to us, and just trying to get this paperwork done, which is, again, very frustrating to the public, and it's not government working right. It's making it very difficult, and this will make it one-stop shopping because DCBS will have the home from cradle to grave. I mean, they'll know everything about it from the time it was being built, everything about it, where it got placed, who owned it, et cetera, until the time that it's no longer being occupied. And that just isn't available today to the public. And so we are committed, and we are working very closely with LFO and DCBS to identify what funds, because the bill provides that for any funds that are not expended by us in that first year of collecting transactions, goes to them to help run the program. And so we are committed to making sure that they get everything that they are supposed to, and that it's tracked. And that we can help them with their forms as they put them together, with their data processing system and the transfer of data and everything, so that it will be up and running on time and properly for the public. So,
Carrie, back to you. When I think about the fact that, you know, you folks were already involved in the whole process, to me it would seem to be an enhanced consumer protection potential there, from the standpoint that you would, in fact, there would be some place you could go, no matter what your problem was, relative to that. To manufacture a house.
Senator George, yes, there's that possibility. We hope to be able to gain some streamlining, as has already been testified to. I expect that the compliance issues would be addressed as well, consumer protection compliance issues addressed with the change, and where it becomes a one-stop shopping and puts manufactured home regulation and enforcement all in one place.
Well, it is a different industry. You know, I've toured with Don some of the manufacturing facility. I'm sure many of you have, and I've absolutely been amazed how these things are built today compared to back in the days when we had a mobile home, and it was a thin veneer of aluminum siding with little 2x2s for walls. Where these things, seriously, are some of the strongest structures I've ever seen built.
It's two-story now.
Yeah, and two-story. Yeah. So it's appropriate that, I mean, it's the time that this would occur. Okay, so both of you are in agreement that we can make this thing work. That's the thing I need on the record. I think you said that. I just want to have everyone nod one more time. Okay. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there an opportunity to gain efficiencies with this transfer and reduce costs?
I think Diane was alluded to that as particularly cost for consumer, one-stop shop.
The consumer... I understand that would be a great advantage in terms of agency costs and transferring from DMV to DCBS, where DCBS is already doing certain things. There will be less cost in ODOT for the transfer. There will be increased costs in DCBS. Is there a net savings, or could we expect a net savings by essentially consolidating and hopefully gaining efficiencies?
That's an excellent question. Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, one of the reasons you don't have a recommendation from LFO this morning is we're trying to work through some of those issues. I don't believe that this is an actually one-for-one swapping of programs. The bill does require a few additional components And as with probably any new program or at least a transfer with some additional components, there are going to be some startup costs for DCBS that we're trying to work through and attempt to address. So initially, I don't think you're going to see any cost savings. We're just trying to figure out how that cash flow is going to work and over what time period they will essentially, if you will, break even within the current fee structure, because nothing within the bill really modifies the fee structure to either the licensees or the folks titling and will now be an ownership document. For the most part, the fees, the provisions of the bill, leave the fees at pretty much the same level, subject to rulemaking by DCBS. So we are working through those things, and over time, potentially you could see some efficiencies, but initially I don't think you're going to see any significant cost savings or efficiencies, at least in the first 2 to 4 years transition to get it up and running.
We'll go back and read Diane Belt's Association of County Collectors bullet points 3, 4, and 5, and I think she's right. I think that will be the end result. You're going to have a one place where data is collected. You're going to have central management, simplification for county partners, and to me, I think in the long term, this is going to save money and certainly help consumers. So that's my editorial. Representative Hanson.
Well, second editorial. I did a lot of work when I was county commissioner in terms of transferring and consolidating functions between the county, Multnomah County, and the city of Portland. And there was no question there were always some potentials for some good long-term savings, but the initial costs usually were usually we ended up with the concept that this looks good and we can save money, but we can't afford to do it right now.
Right.
But certainly the long-term structure, I think, would build a lot of savings for a lot of people, but it's hard to find that in this next biennium, just from the standpoint of the transfer and the time element of getting everything put together before you can really closely look at it and see where the savings can come. But I think, based on faith, I think it'll be there.
Mr. Chair, if I might also, Senator Morris, I think that there will be less documents going out the door, so eventually, yes, because see, we do not only title but registration. And so while we're doing two different documents for the vehicle today, they'll only be doing one. So I think eventually there is streamlining. But it does take the startup costs. It does take the transfer. But yes, I think there will be less paper handling, both at the county level and at the state level.
Representative Krieger.
Floating homes are mobile.
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, they're not considered in this bill. They're not considered mobile homes.
That's done through Division of State Lands, is it, I believe?
I'm not sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, the answer is yes. I know it's not ODOT. We don't do boats. We don't do floating homes.
They're leased. They lease land from the Division of State Lands, but I believe that they are treated for tax purposes as
property.
Yeah,
okay. Thank you, too, very much.
Thank you.
And thanks for all the work on this, too.
You're welcome.
Very helpful. At this time, we have John Brenneman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Brenneman. I'm representing Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon today, MHCO. They're casually referred to as park owners from time to time. I took part in the work group on 468. I deferred mainly to Don because he has been opposed to that move in the past, and I let him drive that issue. There were some issues that developed in Senate Bill 690 that he was talking about that I worked with a work group on that as well, and I'm supporting all the bills today, but in particular I would like to speak in favor of the Dash A2 amendment. In particular, on page 5, talking about the limited license. Limited license refers to park owners or operators. We've had changing market conditions over the last few years. There have been a multitude of people that are willing to walk away from their homes and parks for whatever reason. This would allow an owner or operator of that park to step in and rather than go through a tedious abandonment process, that owner or operator could offer some money to buy the home, transfer to the owner or operator's name, fix it up, turn around, sell it, keep it in the park, rather than have another empty space. Don's been gracious enough to work with us on that through the other licensing bill, and I appreciate the fact that he's supporting moving that provision from that bill into this one, because it's going to be very helpful, in particular for small park owners, to keep their parks operating efficiently. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
John, to me, too, that makes so much more sense. If you have an older home, normally they don't survive well a move. If, in fact, that could be left in place, you may be able to offer a value to someone. And it, like you say, it would be an opportunity for a new buyer, and also the fact that that park owner is going to have an opportunity to actually recover maybe some of the loss and also have stability of people being in their park. For continuation of them being in their park.
Mr. Chair, if I might add, during testimony in the Transportation Committee, one of my park owners from Florence came in to testify in support of this concept. In his park, it's not uncommon to buy a trailer for $1,000, put another $1,000 or $2,000 into it, and turn around and sell it for $3,000 or less to keep it going in there. In his park, he has rents that are common in the $200 a month, and that includes water, sewer, and garbage. So if you want to talk about affordable housing, he has it.
Yeah, and you and I have talked in the past about what a tragedy it is when we have, you know, a manufactured housing that in fact is many times just being abandoned and then lost as far as potential for someone to have an expensive home. I think that's a reasonable provision in this amendment to be able to make sure that there's a mechanism there for someone to maybe rescue that before it ends up in a pile of aluminum and
or the junkyard.
In the junkyard. Or parked along the road, as I've seen a couple times.
Yeah.
Senator Boris.
Thank you, Chairman. This is not a very significant question, but just a curiosity. How many businesses are there that are in both manufactured structures and vehicles?
And?
The amendment allows ODOT to retain records relating to businesses dealing in both manufactured structures and vehicles.
Someone's going to save me.
Just out of curiosity.
Mr. Chair.
She knows everything.
Yeah, I don't. Mr. Chair, members, Kelly Taylor again. Senator Morris, very few, like 10 or so, they actually do both. And mostly it's they might take a car in on trade-in or something like that. And so very, very few actually sell both cars and manufactured homes.
Representative Hanson.
Quite a question I have, and this is relates to, I'm not terribly familiar with how the system works now, but I don't want to say park owners, your communities, is there a potential conflict of interest in terms of somebody is trying to, an estate or something is trying to sell manufactured home, and the park has significant power in terms of approving who the new owner is. Is there any potential that by turning people down, not cooperating with the sellers, that they could drive the market down on that manufactured home, buy it, and then turn a significant profit because they're you don't have really a free market in terms of a pure sale. For example, if you had an opportunity to sell it to somebody that was in the business of fixing up and reselling homes, if they didn't have the cooperation of the park ownership, are you taking a segment of the market that might be willing to purchase that out and then deflating the prices of it? And how's the public protected now, and how will they be under the amendment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, John Brenneman again. There is potential, and it's one of the issues that we've talked about when we've sat down with folks behind me, in particular Pat Swak, who fights for protection, and so we've tried to come up with some solutions or some ways to attack along the way. I must tell you that the limited dealer license that we've got in this bill, my park owners wanted a clear exemption from licensing when we started the session, and they didn't have one. They were already in the old licensing bill, and we talked at length about that, and the compromise was this limited license so that you have something to take away if you get into a bad situation. And Don and others, Pat, have argued that there's potential for problem, and there is. I'll admit that. I'm usually in here every session fighting for my park owners who generally, my membership has not been part of the problem, but I fight because of other owners that are out there that cause problem. In House Bill 3069, which passed the House earlier this session, that's our landlord-tenant, manufactured landlord-tenant coalition bill. It has a provision in there that allows the Attorney General's office a little more latitude in trying to go after bad operators. That bill is tied up in some discussions between House and Senate over on the Senate side. We're hoping that that gets freed up and passes yet this session. So I recognize that there's always potential for problems when you're transferring homes and you have to approve the new owners coming in. And I've heard complaints, and I'll tell you that we've sat and talked about it. We've moved forward a little bit to try to take care of Pat's complaints, and we'll continue to sit at the table in the interim and at other times to see if we can arrive at further solutions.
Senator Dukes?
What Representative Hanson is talking about is indeed a reality. Sometimes I think it's not the park owners, but sometimes their employees. I recently sold a mobile home, finally, in another state. And because the manager of the park thought I had sold it, he called me one night from that other state and to let me make sure I knew that they had to approve whoever I sold it to. I told him I hadn't sold it yet. And he then told me that the owner often bought up mobile homes. And I asked him what price range the owner bought them for, and he quoted me a very low price range, and I told him I was not interested in selling at that level, that before I went there I would move the mobile home and they would have a hole in their park. And after the conversation, he contacted a friend of his and had him contact me and made sure I understood that that friend would be approved to get into the park. And it just got better all the way through. Then he actually hit me up for a finder's fee, a fairly significant one that he wanted me to pay him. Told him he was practicing without a license and could get into a lot of trouble doing that.
And that was Washington State, though, wasn't it?
That was not Oregon. So there are still some dilemmas going on up there with all of this, but it is true. And in this case, I'm positive the owner of the park knew nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But the manager had a side deal going. I don't know how many of these he sold or how many thousands of dollars he's made off of those sales. But he told me what he was hoping I would pay him and what people normally did pay him for selling mobile homes, for which he had no license, but was in a really good position, seeing as how he could encourage acceptance of the application or recommend denial.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, if I might respond, I believe
you. I
hadn't
any of yours.
But But in meetings with the Attorney General's office and representatives there, they've said they've not had complaints, and 3069 allows them more latitude. We need complaints turned in to the Attorney General's office and filed. If that's happening in Oregon, doesn't do me any good, and my organization would like to stop it. And I heard uh-huhs from behind me.
Well, her head's bobbing up.
I can imagine.
Yeah, the thing that we love about Pat is you really don't need to call her up to find out what she's thinking.
I know.
That's why
right.
Nobody pays attention to her.
Oh, we listen to She's not even my constituent any longer, but I listen to her. Okay, we have completed what I believe we've completed, the sign-up list. And is there anyone else who would like to speak to Senate Bill 468, SJR 14, or House Bill 3187? If not, we will close the public hearing that we opened on Senate Bill 468, SJR 14, and House Bill 3187. And with the tap of the gavel, will also be adjourned.